You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses that provide us with not only permission to record these, but also give us the English translations of Rudolf Steiner, and consider patronizing them. They are SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Reimagining Academic Studies. And it's seven lectures. That's Collected Works, Volume 81, translated by Judith Vermouth Atkinson. And this is Lecture 2, entitled On the Organization of Humans and of Animals, given in Berlin on March 6, 1922. Most honored participants, I would like to ask you to keep in mind that until last night I was assuming that today I would attend this lecture given by Dr. Kalisko, rather than give it myself. Thus, in the short time I had, it was impossible to prepare properly what I am going to say, and I can only hope that by and large I will be able to present the points that Dr. Kalisko wanted to talk to you about. When we speak about the relationship of the animal world to the world of the human being, from an anthroposophic perspective, we should emphasize that historically there is a connection between present anthroposophic ideas and Goethe's worldview, a fact I have already mentioned twice. Regarding the topic in question, we should consider most of all one of Goethe's first achievements in the area of science, his treatise titled Humans as Well as Animals Have an Intermaxillary Bone in the Upper Jaw. We have to imagine all the circumstances that led Goethe to write this treatise, which is based on his extensive studies in the areas of anatomy and physiology, and on some embryological studies. Goethe became involved with these questions first as a young student, and then later as a friend of the Jena University Institutes, which to a certain degree depended on him. When he started dealing with the question of the main difference between human and animal, Goethe realized that everyone was eager to find something in the structure or the morphology of humans and of animals that would point to a strict distinction between the animal world and the human being, the crowning glory of creation. People believed they had found a profound difference between human and animal precisely in the structure of the head, in the fact that the so-called intermaxillary bone, which in animals is clearly separated from all other jaw bones, is not a separate bone in the human being. Goethe did not pay attention to that. Since human and animal have in general an analogous structure, he was convinced that such a detail could not express differentiation. Since in adult individuals the intermaxillary bone has grown together with the rest of the jaw bones, Goethe was trying to prove that this is the result of a later development, and that the human embryo has the same intermaxillary bone structure as the animals. We should observe the enthusiasm with which Goethe points out that he had succeeded in demonstrating that both humans and animals have an intermaxillary bone, and that consequently there is no profound difference between them to be found in details of their structure or morphology. Thus we cannot say that Goethe shared the view of the strict separation of the human from the animal world that was characteristic of the 18th century, and anthroposophy does not share this view either. Goethe did assume a transformation in the process of development from the organization of animals to the higher organization of humans. The individual organs that are already present in the animal are transformed. Once the organs are transformed, they can manifest in this transformed animal organization the inner world of the human being as a whole. Goethe thought only of an ascending metamorphosis of the animal world into the human, and not of an independent human morphology. This viewpoint should also be the basis of our anthroposophic search for the differentiation between the animal and the human organism. If the forms of organization are based simply on the metamorphosis of the animal and of the human, then looking for the differentiation, we should observe particularly the processes of life in humans and in animals, how the organs of humans and of animals function. In other words, we should look for a biological rather than for a morphological difference. The idea that there is a biological difference anticipates future scientific developments by examining the foundation of the functioning in animals or that which is related to the sensory organs in both humans and animals. Sensory organs, or rather their functions, are vital for more or less everything that is happening in both animal and human organisms. We should assume that some functions of a primitive form of the senses occur even in the simplest nutritional processes, in the metabolism of the lower rank of animals. This would mean that, for example, the experience of taste occurs parallel to the more or less purely chemical process of metabolism. These processes become more and more differentiated as we follow the development of higher animals up to the human being. However, if we analyze animal organization objectively, we will never find anything that does not involve some form of sensory experience. We can certainly ask how this sensory experience relates to the formation of lymph or of blood and so forth. Currently, science that is not influenced by anthroposophy speaks of the unconscious processes of the human psyche. Even though I can mention this only briefly because of insufficient time, I would say that it is plausible to ask why we assume that the experience of taste in the mouth and at the gum, the experience of taste that occurs under the influence and because of the function of ptyalin or pepsin and so forth, is not brought to the unconscious. Why should the experience of taste, and I am saying this as a postulate of sorts, not expand throughout the entire organism? Why do we not think that unconscious experiences of taste might be occurring parallel with the formation of lymph and blood and all other processes in the organs of which we are not conscious? Once we begin to observe the life of the senses, we will certainly be able to analyze human and animal organization from a biological perspective. As I have been telling some of you for years, and as natural science already accepts, the life of the senses occurs in more than the five senses usually mentioned. There are actually 12 clearly distinguished human senses. This applies only to the human being. Those who recognize the possibility of more than the five or six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, touching, will accept that it is justifiable to speak, for example, of a sense of balance. This sense allows us to recognize internally whether we stand on 2 feet or only on one, whether we perform a movement with one or the other arm, and so forth. When we place ourselves in the world as human beings, we take a position of balance. We perceive our own position of balance with our senses, just as we perceive what occurs in the process of seeing, though in a somewhat more obscure way. Hence, we can talk about a sense of balance as surely as we talk about a sense of sight. We should be clear that when we use the sense of balance, we are focusing on our own organization. In a way, we look inward. While using our eyes, we look outward. Nevertheless, the basis of our experience of balance is certainly some function of the senses. we could expand the number of senses in another direction too. When we simply hear a noise, the functional processes of the human organism are substantially different from the processes of listening to speech, which is a different kind of hearing. In hearing speech, we perceive, again, directly through our ears, but we focus also on what we perceive indirectly through language. When we follow the words, the sentences of another person, using our inner understanding, then we are dealing with more than our judgment. The process of judgment is preceded by a sensory process of perception. Therefore, we should speak of having a, quote, sense of speech, close quote, or rather a sense of language or of words, like our sense of hearing. Put in another way, if we look at words from a more anatomical or physiological viewpoint, we should assume that within the organization of the human, there exists a special organization of the senses that corresponds with listening to what is said, just as the organization of the hearing sense corresponds with listening to unarticulated sounds. Consequently, we should assume the existence of a special organization of the sense of speech that is similar to any other sense organization, such as the senses of sight or hearing. If we approach this objectively, we should not say that we recognize another human being because we see things like a nose, two eyes, and so forth. We should not make an assumption, based on analogy, that in this thing that stands before us, there is a human being simply because in ourselves there is a human being that reveals itself in the outer world through a nose, through eyes, and so forth. In fact, such an unconscious conclusion is not the basis of recognizing another human. Rather, there is an immediate grasping of the other human that must correspond with something special in the human organization, something that can be compared only to the organization of senses. In fact, we could speak of a sense of the self that helps us recognize ourselves in the other. If we understand the functioning of the human being completely objectively, we will be as justified to speak of sensory organizations for the perception of words, of thoughts, and of the self, not of one's own self, however, which is based on something totally different. As we are in speaking of the sensory organization of hearing, of speaking, and so forth. Furthermore, we should be able to speak of a sense of movement, since it is one thing to move and another to stand still, and we perceive the difference. Similarly, we should speak of a sense of life. Natural science already speaks of it to a degree. If we define in this way the number of sense organization systems, we will come up with 12 human senses. Some of them, however, are inner senses, since we perceive our inner organism as well. We perceive how we feel with regard to our sense of balance or to our sense of movement. Nevertheless, the quality of our experience of the inner organization is absolutely the same as the quality of the processes of seeing, hearing, or tasting. Thus, it is all about looking at things in the right context. If we take as a starting point an integral physiology of human senses, we will see certain significant biological phenomena, both in humans and in animals. The significance of these phenomena will remain the same, even if we completely agree with the new theories of the relationship between the morphological and physiological organization of humans and that of animals, including with Haeckel's theory. Here, however, we can observe the most impossible misunderstandings. For example, it is believed that anthroposophy must be opposed to Haeckel's theory simply because anthroposophy is trying to progress from observation through sense perception to the higher level of empirical observation of the spiritual. It is believed that based on this background, anthroposophy must change something in Haeckel's theory. No. If there is anything to be corrected in Haeckel's theory, it should be done using the methods of natural science, and anthroposophy has nothing to say about it. Natural scientists can argue with Haeckel themselves. What anthroposophy has to say relates to a completely different area. We have the right to emphasize that if we count the bones of the higher animals, the number will be the same as that in human beings. The same applies to the number of muscles. But this is not the way to differentiate between human and animal organization. However, if we approach the issue from the viewpoint of biology, then we see a real differentiation. Then we come to appreciate the fact that the human organization has an essentially different place in the universe from that of animals. When we observe the higher animals, we have to say that an important element of their development is the position of their spinal axis, which is parallel to the surface of the ground, while in humans it is just the opposite. In the process of human development, the horizontal position of the spine has changed into a vertical one, and thus one of the most important functions of humans is to stand in an upright position. I realize that people could object and point out that there are also animals that have a more or less vertical spinal axis. The question, however, is not how a species appears in relation to an external morphology, but what the nature of its entire organization is. In particular animals, such as some birds or even mammals, the possibility that their spines could be brought more or less to an upright position is an assumption. In fact, an upright position would be a sign of degeneration, considering the nature of the animal's organization. By contrast, for humans to have an upright position of the spine is precisely in the nature of their organization. Once, years ago, when I mentioned this at a lecture in Munich, an educated natural scientist came up to me and said something I could understand very well. Quote, "But when we sleep, the spine is, nevertheless, in a horizontal position." Close quote. I told him that this is not what matters. What is important is how the spine is positioned in relation to, say, the bones of the legs or the feet in relation to the rest of the body, considering the entire cosmic context of the human being, and also how this positioning affects the human or the animal. Our spine is certainly in a horizontal position when we sleep, but this horizontal position is external. The inner dynamics of our body are organized in a way that allows us to take an upright position of balance in which the spinal axis is vertical. When animals bring themselves to such a position of balance, they are either degenerated to a certain degree, or they develop some human-like functions, a fact that only proves what I would like to explain next. We could say that already in the first years of life, human beings find for themselves their own position in the balance of the universe. They form the vertical position of their spine, a position that is different from that of the animals, for purely functional reasons, because of the entire dynamics of their being. At the same time, each being is formed as part of the entire universe, and one could say that beings adjust to the universe. I will not elaborate on this right now. Observe further the structure of particular bones in the human being, such as the ribs or the skull. We see in the forms of the ribs or the skull of a human or of a dog that from a morphological point of view, it is possible to find signs of adjustment to the vertical or horizontal position of the spine. By positioning themselves vertically, humans live a completely different life compared to that of animals standing on four legs. They live in a different position of balance, and thus in a different cosmic context. Now, let us try to approach the problem from a different angle and clarify what is really happening in the human being in terms of sensory processes, and what is happening as a consequence of those sensory processes. All this could be translated into a very precise biological or physiological terminology, but because of insufficient time, here I will only outline what I want to discuss. Let us consider the visual process. We could subdivide it into the specific functions of the visual organ and into the processes that occur further as a continuation on the physical level. What I want to stress here as analogy is the fact that the optic nerve begins in the eye and then disappears in the rest of the system of nerves. Hence we can distinguish between the visual process itself and what follows in the whole process of life. The imaginative element is also inherent in the immediate visual process. That is, when we look at something, we do not separate the imaginative element from the visual process. If we turn our eyes away from the object we are looking at, we still retain its image, an image that is clearly related to the object perceived in the visual process. Those who analyze this correctly would see how different the imaginative result of a visual process is from that of an auditory process. Within ourselves, I want to stress, we experience the visual process in a dualistic form. On the one hand, there is something related to the real sense perception, and on the other hand, there is something that is like an imaginative remnant and that stays with us more or less as a formed memory. Take now everything that lives in the human imagination, but that is based on the five senses. Most of what is in the psychic life of the human is based on the visual process. We perceive very few imaginations through the auditory process in comparison to the number of things we perceive in the visual process. If we observe the inner life of our psyche, we will find even fewer things that are based entirely on it alone than the things that are based on the processes of seeing, hearing, and so forth. We do know that the imaginative element, which leads to lasting memories, plays some role in the life of our psyche. But this role is much less significant than the role of the visual and auditory processes. We can now pose the question, does this duality exist also in the cases of the more hidden senses, such as the sense of balance or of motion? Is it the same duality we see in the visual sense, between the element of perception and the element of imagination? To a really objective physiology or psychology, this duality should exist in the case of the sense of balance too. But we usually fail to see the connection. In the previous lecture I just gave, I discussed mathematics and the ability to find one's way in spatial relations where the mathematical element is used for the purposes of geometry. What is it really that we are doing when we construct spatial relations? With respect to the human being as a whole, we do exactly the same as when we clearly separate perception from imagination in the visual process by retaining the image internally. We perceive a color not only externally, we also experience the qualitative element of the color, the nuance, and we even have the feeling of a warm or of a cool color, a feeling that persists internally. Thus, we could take as a task at some point, in an extensive inspection of the psyche, to collect all the images that we have established in life because of our ability to see. Then we could achieve an inner visual system in our psyche. We would have built a reconstruction of the external visual process. If you consider the same possibility with regard to the sense of balance, you will come to the realization that through everything you have experienced in your organism, because of your sense of balance, you have reconstructed internally something that corresponds to the geometry of the external world. We did not discover mathematics or mechanics from external experience. We discovered these laws through internal constructing, If you imagine certain mechanical laws, you have discovered them. On the basis of the imaginative element of your sense of balance. In this case, our entire being becomes a sense organ, and we construct internally the other pole, the opposite of perception. For example, we create mathematics and believe that in it we have a pure a priori science. But mathematics is not a pure a priori science. We simply fail to see that we transform the experience of our sense of balance into mathematical and geometrical images, in the same way visual perception is transformed into visual images. Without our noticing this bridge, the perceptions of our sense of balance are transformed into mathematics and mechanics. If we keep this in mind, we will understand the inner connection between the complex human organism and its position of balance in the universe. Then we will realize that the particular experience of balance reflected internally in animals who stand on their four legs and whose position affects the very content of their sense of balance must be very different from the human experience of balance that is reflected in mathematics. We will consider mathematics to be the result of our specific upright position in the universe. We speak of three dimensions because we are positioned in three dimensions in the universe. However, we have reached the vertical dimension thanks only to our own effort in the course of our life. We had to position ourselves in the vertical dimension. Our experience from early childhood is reflected later in mathematics, but this process of reflection does not happen as fast as it does in the visual process. The experience of balance is being reflected in us throughout our lives. As children, we experience our sense of balance in a very strong way when we change from crawling to standing and walking. This change is reflected later in mathematics and mechanics. Often we consider mathematics to be something that we have created. That is not the case. Mathematics is based on the perception of our own organism. Why do we have thoughts that we can relate to the universe so that out of them we can build a whole universe in our thoughts? This is only the result of the way the human being is positioned in the universe. And if we compare now the animal's position of balance with regard to the universe to that of humans, we can see that animals are bound to the organization of the earth. Humans, on the other hand, by standing in an upright position, lift themselves up away from the organization of the earth. Our ability to express independent thoughts is a consequence of human beings having achieved an independent position of balance. As we see, our upright position in the universe is an achievement that is more deliberate than simply following the laws of the organism. And this is not found in animals. In establishing their organism, humans can achieve this only in the first years of life. It is a process that affects every single organ. This is how we come to a polarity within the human being. On the one hand, humans stand and walk in an upright position. And everything that started out the same in humans and in animals has to be adjusted to this cosmic position in which humans exist. On the other hand, the soul gives birth to thoughts that transcend the sense perception of what we see or perceive with the five senses. Thoughts that in fact liberate us from sense perception. Humans detach themselves from the earth through their position in relation to the universe. In the same way, thoughts free themselves from their bond to the sensory world and become, in a sense, emancipated. Because of my anthroposophic certainty, I would like to pose the following as something more than a postulate. We must see the position of balance, which we have because of the upright position of our spinal axis, as something that separates humans from the animals. At the same time, we should see the special form of imagination, thoughts, as something specifically human. Those of you who can understand these things from an anthroposophic viewpoint, I will touch on this topic later, can also see that through the particular development of their sense of balance and their sense of motion, humans achieve a more emancipated system of thinking than one based only on the experience of the eyes or the ears. Having understood this, you would also see that for emancipated thinking, the human being must have an inner organization as well. The human being possesses an organization that is simply not to be found in animals, a fact that could surely be proven in material terms. This organization serves the very specific system of thoughts that has emancipated itself from the bond to the earth that animals still have, a form determined by the special human position of balance. Hence, we can say that the human being has established an organ of abstract thinking by coming to an upright posture of the body. So we see in humans an organization determined by their upright position that at first glance shows nothing more than that the organs, which are the same as those in animals, are in a different position in humans. However, this upright posture affects the organization of the nerves and of the blood. Under the influence of this different position of balance, humans develop something that animals cannot have. And here we find the biological difference between humans and animals. This difference is to be found in the physical organization of the human, and not simply in some theory of metaphysics. This is of fundamental importance. Imagine the transformation of the organization that occurs through the change in the position of balance from the animal to the human. Think, for example, of the changes in the thigh, the lower leg, the hands, and so forth. Imagine what it means to have two hands and not four legs. In fact, humans are supplied with the same forms as animals, but the forms are positioned differently and thus have changed or metamorphosed. This could be proven also in terms of anatomy once the necessary tools and methods of experimentation are developed. We are searching for such tools and methods of experimentation in our institutes in Stuttgart. But to find such methods externally and empirically, we should first form in our imagination an idea about what the differences must be. Anthroposophy is not useless regarding the study of the subtle areas of science, such as the study of human, animal, and plant forms, since science does not discover these things through imagination. Once they are discovered, however, they can be validated through science. Looking at the changes caused in organs by the upright position of balance, we can also see that some organs have been transformed into organs of speech. In other words, the organism becomes creative also with regard to speech. We have now an impression of the special organization of the human being that was established simply because humans are an upright walking species, a fact that has consequences reaching deep into the physical world. We have also made conclusions regarding the physiological organism of speech, a place where we cannot define any morphological differences between humans and animals, even though we see differences in a biological sense. These are only a few thoughts that could show how something we search for in an external, profane manner could be studied in really scientific terms. Today I could only outline briefly what I wanted to say. However, if you imagine pursuing these thoughts, then science will certainly find a way to explore the differences between human and animal organization in terms of biology. The end of Lecture 2.